Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 195 for December 21st, 2011, 0MQ. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync AppLink. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, so you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Check it out in the 2012 Ford Fiesta and at Ford.com/technology. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz. It's a big special show today because we are live in the Petaluma studio, the Petaluma Brick House. I have never been here before. It's so great. You should see all the gadgets that are around here. And it's getting a little awkward because we're actually doing the beginning of the show at the beginning instead of at the end like we do. If you watch us live, you know that we take the show out of order. We're doing it at the beginning just like it's supposed to be. Of course, the show isn't just about me. It's about all the things around the open source community, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the small projects, all sorts of great things. And usually helping me out, we have a co-host. This week's co-host is none other than Aaron Newcomb. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks. I can actually just turn and there you are. It's amazing. So it's a little weird, but yeah, it's good to be back on the show and nice to have everybody together in the Brick House. It's great.
Yeah, we're also in a bit of an unusual situation that we're actually in the living room set. If you've seen a lot of the shows done on the Twit Network, you should see that usually when we're doing Floss Weekly, we're sitting over there somewhere, which you can't see, the round table. Aaron's usually sitting there when he's in the studio, but we're in the living room set because we wanted to be comfy and also because we have our guest in the studio with us, and we thought the living room set would be much better for that. So let me go ahead and introduce our guest. Our guest is Peter Hinchins. He's here all the way from Europe somewhere, and he's going to talk about one of those foreign places over there, right? And he's going to talk to us about 0MQ, but we'll get to that in a moment. 0MQ is a really wonderful piece of software, a framework for creating really intricate connections, really high performance, multiple fan outs, well, lots of stuff. We'll let Peter tell us what it really is all about. But we do have, of course, to help us pay all of our costs, we do actually have a sponsor for this week's ad, or this week's, we don't have a sponsor for the ad, we have a sponsor for this week's show for Floss Weekly, and let's go ahead and have Leo tell you about that.
Hey, Leo Laporte, Brick Twit House, and once again, I want to show you the cool stuff Ford is doing in their new vehicles. This is the 2012 Ford Fiesta. Very affordable car with great features, including the Ford Sync. I want to show you how Sync now can use mobile apps on your phone, like Pandora, Stitcher to listen to iPods, Pandora to listen to music, OpenBeak to listen to tweets, and they just added Slacker Radio, too. It's pretty amazing. First, let's get in the car. Almost everything you do with this Ford Sync, you do with your voice. And, you know, I kind of like that. So here's the Ford Sync button here on the turn signal. Let's turn the car on, and I'll show you how it works. Let's have Pandora running. I'm going to connect this to the USB connector. Notice USB connector right here. I'm using the standard iPhone cable. That's great because it's also charging the phone while I'm listening to it. I can just keep it here, make phone calls, and I do it all with my hands on the wheel, my eyes on the road. Just press this button.
Mobile apps, please say a command.
Pandora. So now my Pandora is connected, and I can listen to a station. Let's say I'll play a station, Lady Gaga. How about that?
Pandora, please say a command.
Play station Lady Gaga. So now I'm listening to Lady Gaga. This is great because it means as I'm driving along, I can listen to songs that I love from artists that I love. I can even create new stations. If I don't like a song that's playing, I can thumbs down it. If I like it, I can thumbs up. In fact, let's do a thumbs up right now.
Pandora, please say a command.
Thumbs up. Thumbed up. How about skip?
Pandora, please say a command.
Skip. All right, now we're rocking. This is all streaming in via 3G. So I can be just driving down the road listening to great radio. If I want more information about a song or I want to buy a song, I can tell it. I can create new stations. So the beauty of this is I don't have to take my eyes off the road. I know it's on the display there, but I don't have to. I can just drive along and I can say, well, what was that song? And it will tell me. I just love that. So you can see how easy it is. You can listen to podcasts using Stitcher. You can listen to music using Pandora. You can even have your tweets read to you with OpenBeak. That's the sync with the new app link. More and more apps all the time, which means more capabilities from Ford Sync. And you don't have to do anything. As long as you got the apps on your phone, that's all you need. Pretty cool. Drive one today at a Ford dealer near you.
So we're back. Hey, great dad. Thank you, Leo. And taped Leo anyway. So I'm a little giddy. This is new for me to be in the studio like this. So I'll probably stop talking about that now. Also, if you're watching the video, you may see that my beard is now at day 32. So I'm keeping it for a little while longer. I don't know exactly when I'm going to get rid of it, but I may never get rid of it. It may just be this is my new look. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway, so let's go ahead and get started. Peter, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little. Start by introducing yourself.
Well, good morning, Randall, Aaron. Very nice to be here.
Thank you.
I've been doing software for 30 years, right? And I guess most of that time has been doing infrastructure, connecting systems. We used to call that integration, system integration.
Mm-hmm.
And ZeroMQ is one step on a long journey of making it cheaper and easier to connect moving pieces. That's what I do.
Yeah. And how does ZeroMQ, well, can you sort of give us a 30,000-foot view of what ZeroMQ is for and what problem it's trying to solve?
Let's look at the problem, first of all.
Yeah,
I think every good story starts with this, what I call this technology curve, where every 24 months, the number of moving pieces doubles or the cost halves.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on for a long, long time. And with computers, you used to have, like, you know, 50 mainframes in the whole world. And now you carry 50 computers on your person, probably one in each pocket in your case.
Yeah.
And it's how much does it cost to connect these usefully? It used to be, you know, several millions of dollars for a bridge. And we've been working on getting this down. So ZeroMQ is really about how to connect pieces, thousands of moving pieces. It's the same scenario you might have inside a large bank, 1,000 computers. How do they get to talk to each other? Becomes now a problem for our, you know, personal cloud of devices, certainly on clouds, but also just in the home and in the business. So ZeroMQ takes a very interesting approach to scale, where pieces don't know about each other, where they can interconnect with minimum cost, also in knowledge, also technology in software terms and just pure cost of effort. And does it by applying what we call patterns, pub-sub, push-pull, where pieces can just spread out information, spread out work, get back results very, very quickly, very easily. That's the basic idea.
Also, the internet is built around the idea of having a socket and things connecting to a socket. And that's obviously been used to transfer information back and forth. How is ZeroMQ different from just a classic socket?
Well, a socket's an API. Okay, a socket is a very successful, very simple metaphor for how you talk to a communications mm-hmm. infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
The internet's based on a whole stack of protocols, as we know of, which some are available through sockets, right? And I think Martin Sustrick's insight in ZeroMQ2 was to move from a rather more complex API onto a very simple socket API. And this made ZeroMQ suddenly very easy to use, very easy to understand. It's still much more profound than a normal socket. A normal socket gives you access to a TCP or a UDP or HTTP interface.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty simple point-to-point interface. UDP is actually more interesting. It can do things like broadcast, multicast. Now, a ZeroMQ socket is really like a little server. It's a little high-powered communication server that can do a lot of interesting stuff very, very quickly. And you talk to it through a socket, looks very simple, but does a lot for you. So with just a very few lines of code, you get suddenly this supercharged ability in your application.
Like a socket on steroids.
That's what it was called.
So would you define it as a protocol then? Or an an implementation of a combination of various protocols in a certain way? How do you define it then at the most base level?
So there are protocols, but they're not the most significant thing. But ZeroMQ is really about getting patterns for scalability and then getting those patterns into your code really easily. So let's say you want to distribute work. You have a cluster of servers that can do things like image processing. You've got 1,000 servers. How do you talk to 1,000 servers? You can't sit there and address each one of them. You don't know when they come and go. They may crash. They may restart. You may have some servers with one core, some servers with 50 cores. How do you get that to orchestrate? So a smart pattern can distribute work to those servers, get back results, and that can be available to an application in a few lines of code. That's what ZeroMQ sockets do.
I just want to take this back a little bit, though. So one of the things that ZeroMQ, the thing that's really remarkable for when I'm studying it and looking at it, is it's in contrast to AMPQ, however you pronounce that?
AMQP, yeah.
Okay, all right. AMQP, I had the letters in the wrong way order, right? That's okay.
Advanced message queuing system.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense then. I understand you had a lot to do with that to start with. Can you talk about what that is and was and why ZeroMQ was sort of birthed as a result of some problems that resulted with that?
So we were, a guy at JP Morgan Chase Investment Bank called me in 2005, I think, 2004 possibly, and said, we've been trying to build this, we have this problem that messaging is really expensive for us. It literally costs us $1 billion a year to connect our systems, and it's too much. And we want to make a new open standard and open source implementation. And we've tried a couple of times, and it keeps failing. Mm. And we've seen that your company makes open source and infrastructure and communication stuff, so could you help us? So I spent the next couple of years mostly in London with my team and JP Morgan Chase team, investment bank, designing this protocol, implementing a open source implementation, OpenAMQ, and migrating their largest system onto that. So it was three projects in one, very, very tough couple of years, actually. And out of that came a very nice little protocol, AMQP. Version 6 or version 0.6, version 0.7, and open source implementation.
Now, AMQ already existed as a protocol, and you were just...
No. We made it.
Okay, all right.
That was mostly my work, was designing the protocol, and then I moved on to making the server implementation.
All right.
And we built it from scratch. Protocol is based on a number of concepts. It's really, the semantics are similar to JMS in some respects. So the kind of level of operation can be compared to JMS. And we were actually taking out JMS systems at the time.
That's the Java messaging system?
Java messaging system.
Okay.
But the goal was to be, I guess, a lot of similar goals as in ZeroMQ, to be completely portable, to work with any language, to be very neutral in terms of technology. Mm-hmm. So transferring blobs rather than, XML, whatever. And then the AMQP got handed over to this industry work group, which, seen from the seat of a small company, is basically insane. Large industry work groups are basically insane organizations. They think very slowly and very stupidly. Smart engineers, but the process is insane. And AMQP went off the rails, basically.
The design by committee problem.
It went way off the rails. So if you look at AMQP now, it's something very strange. Mm. I would never implement that.
Wow.
I would never use that. I would use AMQP, the old version,
right?
Classic.
Because you designed
AMQP
it too,
classic. With all the improvements made by the other great guys in the group, right? We weren't the only team working on that. But it's basically a dead protocol, the old classic version. So in 2007, Martin Sustrick and myself decided that it was time to make a new something. Mm-hmm. And we wrote this white paper where we basically said, look, it's time to make really fast, cheap messaging, especially for financial systems, which is what we knew. And we looked for funding from a few places, and people were like, nah, this is not going to fly. Nobody wants this. Mm. That's the way it usually goes.
Yeah.
So we made it anyway. And basically, at that point, I was tired of programming. So Martin and his team made all the software, and I built the community. Mm. That was the delegation. And that worked really well. So ZeroMQ is really two things in large. It's the software, but it's also the community. For me, the community is, of course, since I'm responsible for that, is more important. Hundreds of people working very actively on all parts of it, from documentation to packaging to implementing it in APIs in different languages to using it, feedback, issues, the whole thing.
This obviously isn't a labor of love for you. So what's the financial model that makes it work for you?
Well, it's a labor of love to some extent.
Okay.
I mean, just doing stuff that's fun and that's new and that's impossible is always interesting, right? Doing something that's impossible. I mean, we're competing with very, very large companies on this, and we're beating them. We're getting contracts that should be going to very large messaging companies, and they're not being able to compete with us.
To what do you attribute that success?
Making the right stuff at the right time.
Okay.
So it's almost the hardest problem in software development is... not writing the software, that's easy. That's a solved problem. It's making the right software. Accuracy is very, very difficult. making it the right level, making it simple, making it usable at the right time. Anyone can write software. Making the right software is very, very hard. And this is one thing that the community does very well. So this is the beauty of open source, is that because everyone's making stuff that they need at the moment, no one's investing just for fun. Nothing comes into use that's not actually required. Not a line of code is there for luxury. It's all basic essentials. And we strip down and we remove stuff from ZeroMQ that's not being used. We take out code that's not being used. So then how to make money from open source? That's kind of your question, right? Yeah. And I'm thinking there's a few answers. It depends how big you are as an organization. If you're a big company, you sell, you market stuff. You sell big things to big customers. If you're a small company, what you do is you attack big companies. And you try to create a niche where you're the monopolist as a small company, a small team. And you can see open source as a very aggressive, competitive strategy. A little team can take out a big market very effectively. When you do that, customers come with money. And they need to build add-on products, they need services. And ZeroMQ is already starting to be a very interesting and lucrative market for anyone who's good in that area. If you're an infrastructure specialist and you know ZeroMQ and you can use it in anger and you have a couple of years' experience, you can demand a lot. It's really very, very valuable.
Mm-hmm. But do you offer, and maybe I missed it, you were talking about services, like support services, I'm assuming. I mean, do you offer those types of things? Or is it?
For sure, yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. I think everybody who is... selling software as such is almost impossible, right? It's just shrink-wrap knowledge. Selling your skills as an architect or as a developer can be worth a lot of money. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm doing now. I'm actually working in Dallas, building strange, large, distributed ZeroMQ systems that I can't talk about, unfortunately.
Right. Well, you did mention financial institutions is one of the areas that type of company that might use this type of software. What other industries or areas would use this? I noticed on the website, I think supercomputing is one application area that may use this technology.
To be honest, anyone with moving pieces. So literally any organization that has more than 5 moving pieces needs cheap connectivity, needs performance. We're all competing. We're in a global competition for the dollar per transaction, cost per transaction. So if you're doing cloud computing and you have system A and system B, and system A can do 100,000 a second and system B can do 3 million a second, it's a fairly easy choice. Mm-hmm. And people do make this leap from, proprietary messaging or handmade messaging to AMQP, and then they arrive at ZeroMQ because it's just faster.
Right. And we're talking cheaper. About the differences we're talking about. We're not talking about changing out hardware infrastructure, right? This is just using a different way to communicate on the same hardware, same equipment, and
That's
it goes that much faster.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Now, do you require a special type of infrastructure to be able to use this? Or, I'm an infrastructure guy, so I'm thinking, okay, we're going to need to set up InfiniBand connections between all the servers and the storage. And, is there a requirement there, or is that really not a concern?
Not a concern.
Okay.
Some people do that, especially if they're in particular areas where latency is very important.
Right.
Then, if it's 10 microseconds or 3 microseconds, that matters. Then you might go to InfiniBand, for example. But most of the time, and I think the really large market for ZeroMQ is just to replace hand-built messaging, hand-built TCP connections.
Right.
And there are thousands of products that still do this. They make their own communications, and it's painfully expensive and complex. And it's done the wrong way. That's the thing, is that once you connect pieces explicitly, A talks to B, and A knows about B, and B knows about A, you're dead. You can't add C, you can't add D, let alone 1,000 A's and B's. And the future is scale. There's no argument. You can't go back to a world of 10 computers. We are going to a world of 10 trillion computers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is there a type of implementation that you have to be at before you can start looking at this? I mean, what's the beginning point where someone says, whatever I have now or the application that comes standard from Oracle or Microsoft isn't working, I need to go do this. I mean, what's the threshold, I guess, that you hit when you say, okay, I need to start looking at ZeroMQ? Or maybe there isn't one. Maybe it's just based on what you're trying to get done, the business you're trying to
get done. I guess it's a little bit like the threshold that people went through to look at databases and SQL as an alternative for you know, simple file structures. It's a question of scale. And as a developer or architect, when you realize that scale is there, most people start by making simple pieces that talk to nothing else except themselves, you know, standalone libraries or applications. Most of what you run on your machine is still completely standalone.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of interconnected components is still quite unusual. It's not just machines, it's also things that run on machines. How many pieces do you have on a machine? How many applications can you run in parallel on a mobile phone or on a tablet? And once you realize that you can connect these together, then you think about how the scale and the cost and latency. Am I using a RESTful interface where a connection is, you know, half a second request response and where every component knows the address of every other component, or do I want something more interesting? So it's about the evolution of a developer or architect in their own view of the problem they're solving.
Mm-hmm.
So the one of the examples of using ZeroMQ is a guest we had on a few weeks ago, Salt.
Right.
Are you familiar with how ZeroMQ is being used by Salt, and can you describe sort of the technology there?
So what Thomas Hatch has made in Salt is a beautiful example of a killer product in a fairly well-understood market. Take ZeroMQ, take the existing problem, solve it again, and you get a killer product.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absolutely beautiful. The previous versions, so what Salt's replacing are very pedantic command and control systems that go and talk to different pieces, and they know a lot about the structure. Salt broadcasts, gets back instantaneously, and remarkably easy to do. I won't say that Salt isn't a big achievement, but the cost of that communications layer is zero. It's all done by ZeroMQ.
I've been playing a little bit with ZeroMQ, and the thing that I see is just it's so easy, and it gets past a lot of the common problems that I would have before, like the idea of a client and a server rendezvousing with each other.
Right.
In the traditional Unix socket sense, the server always has to arrive first.
Right.
And be at a well-known spot, and
precisely,
the client then comes along and connects to it. And because the connection is that direction, you have firewall issues, where the client has to initiate the conversation across. The server can't just say, well, I'm open to everybody and whoever wants to connect up. What I saw you do with ZeroMQ is that the client can start first and the server can sort of connect up to it.
Right.
It almost made it too easy. Was that really the goal?
For a certain class of problems, it makes it too easy. Then there are other problems which you simply can't solve with ZeroMQ. So it's also, you know, you learn where the tool fits, then you use it very well. And then there are areas where you need other tools or we need to wait for the tool to get better.
And I also saw that you have different modes of these connections being made, and you mentioned them a couple times in the show already, but you have this sort of traditional sort of request-response mode where I'm sending out one thing and I want to get response back. But the thing I thought that was sort of unusual about that is you could have a bunch of servers out there, and the request can just go out and go, whoever wants to grab this or whoever wants to grab is available next, grabs it.
Right.
So I, as the client, don't even know which of the many servers are grabbing it, but I know I'm going to get one response as a response back.
Right. And these are the kind of patterns that we saw and had to implement in AMQP, for example. That was what AMQP did very well, was distributing work and information where the sender didn't know who the recipients would be. It's really key to scale. If you know too much about your topology, if topology knowledge is built into the nodes, then you can't scale. You can't add and remove stuff. So it's key to building large-scale architectures that you can add and remove pieces without changing other pieces.
And the pub-sub format is for broadcasting things. So I could have a number of people all coming into a central point and fanning out from there.
Right. And again, a very classic enterprise. I think the Dow Jones Industrial Average still runs on OpenAMQ and AMQP, and it's using a very beautiful pub-sub architecture to send index information out.
Cool. So is this something that could be implemented on, I'm just trying to think of the logistics here. Is this something that could be implemented on a switch level, say a Cisco switch? Could that be used as a server? Or does it have to be built into the applications that are running on the individual hosts? Does that make sense?
Well, the irony is that ZeroMQ is actually the very kickoff was a project with Cisco.
Mm-hmm.
And the kickoff was to make multicast work properly with AMQP for Cisco, and they funded like the first 6 months of ZeroMQ. But where ZeroMQ has gone is really into completely decentralized territory, so that it's in every single application. And the switches can just be completely standard, dumb in quotes because they're still very smart, but just standard TCP or UDP switches. There's no reason to have any centralized authority with ZeroMQ, mm-hmm. be it a broker or a switch.
So let's talk a little bit about the implementation. It's C code, C++?
The core library is in C++, then there are wrappers in C, and then in every other conceivable language.
Right. Yeah, I like that I could pull out a Perl library right away and start talking to things.
Right.
And it's also language agnostic in the sense that you're just shipping a blob across the wire, right?
Right.
And an arbitrary size blob, too. I thought that was sort of interesting that you could send a 10K or 20K blob.
It has to fit into memory. So
yeah.
We send and receive whole blobs. They can be sliced into frames, but they'll be sent and received as a whole thing. So if you're sending files, you have to have your own file, you know, file transfer protocol on top of that where you're reading and sending slices of data. But
And it also manages retries and reopening and resending of things like a request response. It'll pay attention to the response not having come back, or is that something that's at your application level?
Basic ZeroMQ patterns will not do retries, for example. They will try to reconnect if things go away. So they'll recreate the topology, but they will not resend messages if they're lost.
Okay.
On top of that, we build reliability patterns, and in the guide, there's dozens of different reliability patterns. When you lose data, you can resend. When things disappear, you can find another way to get things done. That gets quite complex. That's one of those areas where making fully reliable systems is really very, very hard.
But with tools like ZeroMQ, at least you're starting with a much higher platform.
Exactly, yes.
And how do you get such great performance? How are you getting these huge numbers that you're talking about?
That's thanks to Martin Sustrick and his team. They did an awesome job in optimizing. And look, like the first 6 months was spent just in measuring.
Wow.
Literally just in measuring every single element of the stack. So when you send a message in application, what happens to that message? And what's the impact of the size of the message? And what's the impact of you know, the system calls? And they took this apart layer by layer and put it back together. And then spent a really long time optimizing it. So ZeroMQ does things like very efficient batching of messages. So if you send a whole stream, they'll be batched into blocks and sent as blocks. Fewer system calls, less I.O.
The claim there was faster than TCP.
Yeah, well, it's faster than an average TCP application because the effort required to optimize the application would be impossible. Mm-hmm. So although, of course, ZeroMQ is using TCP, if anyone else was using TCP, they couldn't get it to be that fast. That's the way it is.
When you say fast, you mean fast in latency or fast in throughput?
Actually, in both. Because if you're doing opportunistic batching, you're going to get better latency and better throughput. That's the beauty of it. And then very clever internal multi-threading so that the sender thread can run at full speed and the I.O. thread can run at full speed with no locks, no wait states. So if you have two cores, they're occupying two cores. So if you do like a performance test at ZeroMQ on a four-core box, you'll see four cores all running completely busy.
Wow.
And on my little laptop, which is, you know, a little student Mac laptop, I can do like 8-9 million messages a second through that.
So would this be really good? I'm just thinking again in terms of the thread thing kind of caught my attention. I'm not trying to do a commercial here, but something like Oracle's Spark boxes that have like 64 or 128 threads or whatever. I mean, it sounds like an architecture like that may lend itself a little bit better to ZeroMQ because
you mean the multi-cores.
Yeah,
I mean, this is also one of these predictions of the future is that boxes go to, you know, 64 cores, right. 128 cores. And how do you usefully use all those cores? And traditional multithreading doesn't handle that properly. You have locks, you have wait states, and actually you hit basically a ceiling at about 12, 16 cores, where the cost of connecting threads is higher than the work you get from adding more cores. And one very nice thing about ZeroMQ is that the same patterns it uses for connecting boxes can be used to connect threads in a single process.
Mm-hmm.
So you can build very scalable multi-threaded applications where the threads are basically acting as little tasks talking to each other with no locks, no wait states, no shared state. And then using the same model. So as a developer, you don't see the difference between multi-threading and multi-process and multi-box. It's the same conceptual model.
In fact, you could probably migrate from one to the other without changing too much
of
code.
So we typically start by making stuff that's multiple threads in one process. We test it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we take the threads, break them into processes, test them, different boxes, test them. And it's the same application logic each time.
One of the things I like is the documentation is outstanding. I really learned a lot from the guide and going through the various man pages and stuff. And I thought one of the things I liked is that you had some really impressive architectures that are built using ZeroMQ. Can you describe some of what's possible in terms of topologies?
you'd have to read the guide. there'll be a paper version sometime and available for $29.95 from Amazon.com. But basically, with CRMQ and the guide, we try to capture all of our experience of building large scale systems. I mean, this has been a long career for most of us in the core team. And how to do these things again using CRMQ. So if you get that, download this PDF, read it online, then you get a lot of good experience, I think. Yeah.
Good. Now, in terms of from previous work that I've done with different companies in the past, I know that troubleshooting messaging problems can be painful.
Yeah.
Is there anything built into or tools that you have developed to help with troubleshooting messaging problems?
I just call it printf.
The standard.
It is a problem, and it's a problem because you have moving bits that are asynchronously talking to each other. So when things actually happen can be very unclear. Mm-hmm. I would love to see little animations and debug flows and so on. We don't really have that. So we help people to debug CRMQ applications by making it really easy to make them. You can build them in Python. You can debug all your flows in a very easy language. Mm-hmm. You can do it on a single box with threads, and you can scale it out, and the same code will work the same way. So the same bug will work the same way. So in the end, it's quite easy to...
So wait a second. So if I've got a bug in... If I'm writing a Python script, let's say, that uses this, and then I implement it, assuming that my language skills are good enough, I say, I'm having this bug, and then I take it and I rewrite it in Perl, I'll see the same bug? Is that what you're saying?
If the bug is at the level of your message flows, yes.
Okay.
If it's in your Python script,
then it becomes obvious because then all of a sudden the Perl script runs, a lot faster or whatever. Right. The problem goes away. So, okay, that's interesting. It's actually not a bad way. If you know multiple languages,
yes,
it's not a bad way to test what you're doing.
And also,
I'll just write it in Perl and see if it works over there. Hey, it works great. Must be my horrible coding skills in Python. So, yeah.
And it's a great way to not have to pay too much to develop code. You make everything in a cheap language, and there where you need more performance, you can write it in C or in C++.
Mm-hmm. How many people are working on this, did you say?
This morning on IRC, there were 140 people.
Wow.
That's on the IRC channel.
Nice, nice.
I think the mailing list has over 1,000 people. I didn't count the number of projects on GitHub, but it must be over 50.
Mm. Wow, that's great. And then all of these are, how many submits do you get back from is it, is there a core group out of that number of people, or like five people that really do all the code, or do you get patches submitted from all over?
So there's a core project. The core project is basically done by Martin Sustrick. Okay? Mm-hmm. And credit to Martin. He's been doing this for now for 3 years.
Incredible.
With a bunch of people helping him on commits. Around that are a bunch of other projects of various activities. They come and go. Each of them has maybe two to five people helping. A lot of people doing issue reporting, doing packaging, testing releases, doing presentations. It goes on. So it's really hard to say that there's any one single place people are working. It's spread out. It's a very active community. It's large. Just people on IRC helping other people with questions and problems. Go to the email list with a question, unless it's a really silly question, and you'll get an answer, a serious answer, in half an hour from somebody.
I remember jumping onto the IRC channel a couple of weeks ago and getting really fast response. Right. People answering questions right away. Where is this? I think I know the answers, but where is this in the maturity cycle? Is it deployable today? Was it deployable a year ago? So we're already at a place where people can bet the company on it and things like that?
Well, I bet my company a long time ago. So. Yes.
And why would somebody not reach for this and reach instead for something like AMQP or one of the other protocols?
I'm sure there are reasons. I can't think of any good ones. I mean, look.
Spoken like a true champion.
There we go. Yes.
A broker-based product is simpler. Yes, it's simpler to understand. It's simpler to use. If you're learning messaging, which many people are, mm-hmm. then a decentralized model is very confusing. It's hard to understand. Even if you look at the examples in the guide, the complex examples, they all start by building brokers in the middle. And then as we get through, we break them up into pieces. So if you're trying to understand messaging as a concept, and this whole business of asynchronous you know, communication between decoupled pieces, then having a broker in the middle makes it much easier. It's easier to sell to your boss, easier to make stuff that you can actually understand. It removes a lot of the headache of learning. And learning is a big issue.
Mm.
So for those kind of situations, I would say go and use RabbitMQ. It's a great application. It'll give you great results. At a certain point in time, you'll probably be like, it's a bottleneck. Having this broker in the middle is a bottleneck. It's a management problem. And you can then take it apart, do much the same work, but much faster. But there's a learning curve. So ZeroMQ is conceptually harder to learn if you're coming at it from a certain angle. On the other hand, if you don't know what messaging is, and you don't really want to learn messaging as a traditional concept, just take the guide and start learning it. You won't have that problem at all. You'll just start using it. It'll work. So I think it's kind of certain kind of company organization will use AMQP.
You said certain type of organization, but and we talked about some different types of those supercomputing cluster environments, financial environments. What types of applications, though, are these? I mean, are they? I mean, I guess they could be anything, but I mean, are we talking about web servers? Are we talking about financial processing applications or computational processing? I'm thinking in the research applications. What types of applications?
So using ZeroMQ today, it's really gone mainstream. I mean, this was what was happening 2 years ago: research, scientific computing, mm-hmm. high frequency trading.
Mm-hmm.
Those were people who were using ZeroMQ one. Okay, ZeroMQ two has been stable for a year. We're in maintenance mode. We're now making ZeroMQ three, and it's really in mass market mode. So it's anyone who's trying to orchestrate moving pieces. That's it. It's that simple.
Mm.
Which means, you know, components on an Android phone. It means bits in a distributed database. It means cloud computing. It means anything. You know, SALT is a good application again. It's orchestrating information between a bunch of decentralized servers. And that's just the world we live in IT. We're not in the world of big pieces anymore. There are lots of small pieces.
And in terms of to that point, I'm thinking virtualization. Is there any problem since so many people are running in a virtualized environment now? Is there layers that get virtualized that actually might get in the way of that messaging going back and forth?
No.
I was just doing some work on running Linux Mint on top of Windows at home. Right. So I'm running Linux Mint in VirtualBox. And of course, there's always the I/O problem. Even though they've implemented the I/O for the shared folders very well now, but it's still takes twice as long for me to do a given workload inside the virtual environment as it does if I run it on bare metal.
Right.
So I'm just that's the kind of question. That's why I asked that question, is because I know that sometimes that virtualization via a hypervisor or anything else sometimes gets in the way, and your best effort in trying to get the messaging as quick as possible still gets stymied because you're running in a virtualized environment.
Well, obviously, if you have something in the way of your I/O, you want your messaging to be much faster.
Right.
So the fewer cycles you spend on messaging, the better in that case.
Mm-hmm.
We have people doing a lot of ZeroMQ work on virtual boxes. If you really want low latency, you won't do that. You'll use bare metal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's one of those cases where the number of moving pieces increases.
Right.
Yeah.
So the chat room's asking about using ZeroMQ for massive multiplayer games. Are you aware of any use of that at this point? Would it be the right choice for stuff like that?
Yes, and that's been done for at least a year by different people. At least two gaming companies that use it, and at least a couple of other people that I've heard of using it to build large multiplayer games. Yeah.
And again, it's because we have these patterns that have been incorporated into ZeroMQ about publish, subscribe, and request response that enable us to scale up and have these all rendezvous at the right place.
And it's what people would have used HTTP for a while ago. But it's just too inefficient. The cost of every transaction means that you have latency issues, and you can't do real-time gaming over REST. It's not doable.
Yeah, even with a keep alive and not stopping the TCP every time, you still have the problem of just simply saying, here I am again, here's the request I'm making, and here's the
initialization.
Web servers are not optimized for performance in terms of the latency per message. That was never a concern.
And speaking of web server, though, there is a web server written, I think, in Python that uses RMQ to...
Mongrel 2, yes.
There we go. And what's that architecture? How does that work?
So this is a great product. One of the first open source products to use RMQ in Angular and has a lively community. When I say in Angular, I mean for its, you know, Zsharp bet Mongrel 2 on RMQ. And it's basically acting as the... what you call it, the fast CGI replaces the back-end connectivity. Applications can then plug into the web server over CRMQ in any language and produce bits of the page, at least that. And it's very nice. It's
so
a
nice
example.
You have a front end that's talking HTTP to the client, so they don't know the difference.
Right.
But somewhere there's a layer in the middle where the worker bees can kind of wake up and say, I'm now available for work.
Right.
And then CRMQ just handles the distribution there, so... from the programmer's perspective, he's just simply saying, I've got a request, it's going out, and some receiver is going to pick it up and hand it back to me when I'm done. Wow. Because I keep thinking how hard that is to code, and we have to do it from scratch every time.
And how else would you build a web server with 100 moving pieces?
Well, we see how Apache did it, you know, with all the pre-forks and all that stuff, managing all that. And it's expensive, that communication process that's in the middle there, and CRMQ just sort of gets rid of all that.
Yes.
Plus, it even gives you the ability to move, which you can't do with Apache, it gives you the ability to move those worker bees on multiple machines then.
Put them anywhere you like, exactly.
Wow, this is cool.
Yeah, cool stuff. And it doesn't seem like this would be, there was a comment in here, I don't think it's applicable, but there was a comment on the IRC about doing, not necessarily video editing, but video rendering. But I think the problem there is that you're really, the processing, it's not so much the messaging. So I'm not sure that RMQ would really
so for render farms, for example.
Render farms, exactly.
Well, it's a similar problem. I mean, you're trying to orchestrate work between a cloud of worker bees. You never know which one's going to be available. So you have queuing, you have, you know, work piling up in queues, you have worker bees coming to take away the work and then come back when they're ready. And they have to talk to this queue somehow. The queue has to sit somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not be in a low latency issue because the, you know, every frame may take whatever 5 seconds to render, so you may not have a latency problem, but you have a scale problem. You have worker, you know, you have farms of 5,000 renderers. You want to add another 1,000. How do they, you know, who do they talk to? Who knows that those 1,000 came online? How do they interconnect? And with CRMQ, it's literally trivial to make that. Literally, assuming you have your rendering in. Stuff
the
where
other
the connectivity becomes trivial.
Right. Yep. Cool. Very cool.
Yeah. And so one of the things I really liked when I was playing with RMQ, just in preparation for the show, actually, but I'm now pretty excited about it. I'm actually looking at a lot of different things with it. But,
you should be.
The thing I liked was that it fit into an event loop easily. At least we got pretty close to it. One of the other projects I'm working on for my primary client is... we're building a RabbitMQ thing, and I'm like, I keep trying to say, why don't I just make it RMQ? In fact, some of the part of the company is already using RMQ for other stuff, so they were excited about me coming to talk to you today. And but the architect for the section that I'm actually involved in says, no, we've got to have RabbitMQ, and we've got to use NetStomp to talk to it. And it's like,
sure,
you know, because the problem was is that NetStomp, at least the Perl client, can't be it can't be put in an event loop because it's blocking interface.
Right.
And so I like that you have not only a built-in event loop, but also a way to drop, I think you can even drop the sockets into a standard event loop.
Right. So you can basically, in one event loop, you can work with standard sockets, RMQ sockets. It's very, very different. This is, again, the magic of this socket API. It's very different from a conventional messaging API, which is a big, heavy thing.
Mm-hmm.
When we wrote AMQP clients, it took us, I don't know, 3 to 6 months of work to make these. And they're monsters. They are big, heavy APIs that do a lot of work. There's no way they would fit inside an event loop. It's a learning curve. Any messaging is better than no messaging.
So talk more about your community development. How is that going and what motivates you and what's worked so far? So you can share it with other people that might want to do this kind of community development.
So building communities is quite fun. This is kind of my main job, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One of my main jobs, social architect, I call it.
Oh, nice.
And this is a long time journey. You give a community a strong mission, something impossible. With RMQ, we had the fastest messaging ever, which was an insane mission for a little group of gangsters from Slovakia somewhere to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And give them a way to organize around that problem and make it you know, make it beneficial for them, for people to come in and join that project, make it win-win in some way. And people will organize around problems like that. And if it's done properly, it'll grow. There's a whole bunch of little tricks and patterns you can apply to make that work, such as having very clear rules, but not telling people what to do. So this authority is very important, but it has to be very much about the rules, not about the work. We're obsessive with our processes, but we don't care who does what. We will accept a patch from anybody, but it's got to be done the right way, that kind of thing.
Cool. And how, in particular, how is ZeroMQ being developed? Is it like GitHub kind of things?
We use GitHub, which is really good. GitHub is awesome. It's made our life a lot easier. It's taken out a lot of the friction that we had to, you know, overcome before to make stuff happen. And people are increasingly getting comfortable using GitHub to become contributors. We use it for issue tracking, and it works really well. So basically, the process is anyone can start a project. Anyone can claim, make an official project. That's just ask the community, could this be official? And yeah, sure. And then the success or failure is purely defined by its uptake. So if you have an idea for a project on ZeroMQ and you want to push it in there, no one's going to stop you doing it. No one's going to ever say, no, that's my territory. It doesn't happen. We have three competing Erlang bindings. It doesn't matter. No one's in charge. It's just the community that chooses which one they prefer. And over time, that weeds out, you know, creates competition, and it weeds out the worst ones and the ones that aren't maintained properly. And people do decide sanely, I want this particular project because it's better for me. It's you know, better maintained, it's better quality documentation.
That's the same model that the CPAN used, what made Perl so successful, was that anybody could push anything up to the CPAN.
Right.
And it was the marketplace that decided which one worked, or maybe merging the projects was appropriate.
Exactly.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Yes. And all that we really care about in terms of managing the community is the process. So the process for example, how you become a contributor, how you submit a patch, how you make a test case, how we fix issues, how we push changes into stable versions, the difference between stable and experimental, that kind of thing. And we're obsessive with those processes, but that's it.
And what's in the long range then, and who decides that?
No one decides.
Wow.
It's really up to anyone with an idea and the time and the need.
Okay, and where is it going now? Are we gonna have a new version that breaks backward compatibility, or are we gonna keep forward compatible, or what? Nobody knows.
We've tried all of that. So there was this year was a fun experiment because we had three versions running in parallel: a stable version, an experimental version 3, and a completely experimental version 4. Not all of them not compatible with each other.
Oh,
and after about a year of this, we decided to roll back and basically make version 3 compatible with version 2.
Oh, okay.
And drop most of the weird experimental stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, I think, in the stage where stability and, you know, gradual evolution is more important than new functionality, which is a big switch over last year. Because last year we were still saying, you know, bring in new stuff, it's more valuable than compatibility. So that kind of is a sign that we went over the hump of adoption. But that was not planned, that just came out that way. And I had no strong opinion about going either way. It's like, okay, we'll have three versions. That's fine. It's a bit confusing, but people will choose. People did choose, and it seems to have worked very well.
And what license is this under?
LGPL.
So I can link it with my proprietary code as long as.
Right.
But if I make modifications to the library, you want it back.
Right. So we do insist that if you change the library, if you improve it, that, you know, you share this back with us. We're sharing our work. You share your work, but we make no claim on your applications, obviously.
Hmm.
And most people like that. That works for most. There's a few companies that don't like the GPL.
Yeah,
I won't name any names,
reasons,
but
right?
The
yeah,
food
yeah.
chip company has particular problems with the GPL
Absolutely.
Itself.
Sure.
I think for patent issues, and they won't use ZeroMQ, which is tragic.
Well, that's awful.
Yeah,
horrible.
Really awful.
Well, you know, I guess that gives us a competitive advantage whoever does use it then.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're almost out of time, but I wanted to see, is there anything that we've left out that you really wanted to make sure we covered today?
Well, I want to say thank you to everybody who made this possible. It's been, if you're an optimist and you believe in human nature and the goodness of people, this is really a sign that, you know, we can work together to make amazing things happen. So, thanks, guys.
Very good, very good. And where would people go to find out about more about this?
ZeroMQ.org.
That makes sense. And what's the with the zero slash thing in front of the MQ and the logo? Because that's not really zero with the slash.
You'll have to ask somebody else. I have no.
It's a branding.
Branding did that. I don't know what their problem is. Someone get with the branding department on that.
Yeah, it's just meant to be memorable. Which.
Yeah.
And now for the two awkward questions: VI or Emacs?
Sorry.
VI or Emacs? What's your favorite editor?
No, Kate.
Kate. Okay, yeah. I don't even know what that is.
I'm a Kate guy.
Yep. Yeah. I've heard of it.
What is that? Is that Linux thing? What is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, absolutely. No wonder. I don't run Linux anywhere. Yeah. Well, I'll get in trouble for saying that again.
Right. Well, at least you didn't say awk. Awk instead, actually. That's what I use.
Right, right. And your favorite scripting language?
Oh, I don't write code anymore. I just tell people it's impossible.
When you were back doing coding?
Awk.
Awk. There we go. I like it. I'll take it. That's good. Because I used that before I used Perl, so that works out really well. Well, it's been a pleasure interviewing you, especially in person here in the Brick House. If you're not watching the video, you're missing out on this. This is great. We're actually sitting in the studio at the Brick House, like I said at the beginning of the show. And so thank you for coming up to the Petaluma today to hang out with us and chat with us about ZeroMQ. I'm sure a lot of people are going to know about ZeroMQ now that weren't aware before. And I hope to see you successful in what you're doing.
My pleasure, Randall. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks. That was Peter. Except no one actually sending him away because he's still sitting here.
Right,
so.
Right. We have to be careful what we say.
We can't talk behind his back anymore like we usually do on shows like this, right? So what's your takeaway on this?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, this is a really big problem. I mean, it may not be interesting to everyone, but certainly for software developers, if they're software developers or people that are watching the show that may know a software developer, especially if they're working on messaging applications or applications that have to talk to each other, this is something definitely to take a look at because it is a huge problem. I know, in my work, since I'm a storage guy, we deal a lot with latency and throughput. I mean, especially with like OLTP applications where, you know, every transaction needs to be put through as quickly as possible, not only for like you can imagine like a Amazon.com, for example, where they're actually processing. Someone goes and tries to order something. If they don't come back and respond quickly, then that order is lost. They're going to go buy from somebody else, right? They're going to say, ah, screw it. I hate this online stuff. I'm going to Target. So it really, this latency issue and messaging issue really is important. And so for people developing these applications, I think this is a really good thing to look at.
Well, you know, and I also liked it because, when working for my Culver City client, one of the things I was building was a hook in Git so that when code was pushed, it would notify Jenkins that something had been pushed. Mm-hmm. I mean, a very common problem. You want to have things be built automatically when you check stuff into your control system. And we're eventually going to write that using RabbitMQ and NetStomp and things like that. But that stuff hadn't been set up yet, and I didn't want to learn how to set that up because that's knowledge I don't want to take anywhere else.
Right.
But I did want to learn about ZeroMQ because in preparation for the show. So within a matter of minutes, I had the whole thing prototyped up. I had the little hook in there in the Git hook, and I had the receiver, and I set up something that had a pub sub on it so I could actually broadcast it to everybody out there. But it was like 10 lines of code.
That's
it was
great.
Like nothing to it. And it was just installed easily. It installed on Mac ports. It installed and there was a Linux package for it so I could put it on the server, and it was just... I was amazed at how simple that was. And I can't wait to do more socket coding because of this. I can't make to do more of this net type stuff because I'm thinking of all the things I did the hard way in times past. And as a programmer, this excites me. It's hard to get excited about a library.
Yeah.
But I think ZeroMQ's got a huge amount of potential for really solving a lot of those interesting problems.
Right. And just think about mobile applications as well.
Yeah.
You know, Android came out yesterday and said it was like, 700,000 activations of mobile phones.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just kind of crazy, but I mean, you got to remember that as this thing scales up, that there's going to be more and more of these issues. You know, every little thing along the way can be a bottleneck. And if your application doesn't respond very well, I know I'm this way. I pull out my phone, and if an application doesn't work, I'm like, uninstall. I don't need to take up space on my phone with this thing. So, I mean, you got to think about that kind of stuff as you're developing applications, especially in the mobile environment now. So, yeah.
Really yeah. How do you have the same system, you know, how do you have a system scale to the point where you get all these mobile applications all setting stuff in and trying to be on stuff like things like the games like Farmville, We Rule kind of thing where all these little systems want to have real-time interactions. How do you scale that and make it all make sense?
And not only that, but you're playing Farmville or whatever the application is.
Right.
You're playing it on in Chrome. You're playing it on your desktop. You're playing it on the iPhone. You're playing it on multiple versions of Android. And they may be written in different languages. You just have to – it's nice that you have an application like this that you can use broadly across across multiple platforms too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, speaking of broad platforms and applications, that's my awkward transition for the week. Nice. I always do that somehow or another. We have we're still filling in the Q1 schedule, but I'll tell you who we've got so far. We've got next week. We've got Kleber Rosa. I think that's it. Is it? I can't tell. That's Kleber. Kleber Rosa or Kleber Rosa, who's going to talk about Autotest, which is for testing the Linux kernel and a bunch of other things like that. Starting off the new year, we have Terry Gillett and Steve Song talking about the Village Telco Project, which is about using open source software to create real live phone systems to talk to ordinary phones. Very cool thing. I'm really looking forward to that. Sam Aaron's going to talk to us about Overtone, which I believe is a music editing system of some kind or a music performance system. Dave Skoll's going to talk about Remind, which is a to-do manager, really a fancy one for that. David Carver, Sastry Maledi, Turmeric, which I only remember it's something about eBay, open sourced a huge library of something that's really cool. So it's eBay open source software. We're going to talk about what happens behind the scenes in eBay as well. And then rounding out the schedule so far, we have David Mirza, the Vegas security tester. He originally scheduled for today, but thankfully he allowed his slot to be used so that we could get to Peter today. So he's coming back in mid-February to talk about, it's a penetration testing system. So you basically have a pluggable system of being able to attack a website and figure out what's broken with it. Very, very cool stuff. I met him actually in Brazil last year, which is how he got on the show. Bunch more open slots. Go to twit.tv/floss to see our upcoming list, our upcoming guest list as well, people who haven't been slotted in yet. If you see somebody on the list that doesn't have agreed to a show negotiating dates, that's the little tag I put for that, you can feel free to email them and have them email me. That's how people get up to that first part of the list, is that they're emailing me. A lot of people do that. I get about one or two requests a week that way, and then when I go to my quarterly scheduling, I start slotting people in, and it's a lot of fun for me. I try to keep it to a minimum, though. I try to keep my work to a minimum for that. And as I quickly flip back to the other part of my screen here, which is awkward because the thing's sitting on a little stand here, by the way. If you can't see it, my laptop is in a place that's unusual here. So you follow us on Floss Weekly. That's the Twitter on Twitter and Identica handles. You can see them when I book an upcoming guest or reminders about like today's show. I sent out a message a couple hours ago on there. You can follow me, Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, to find out where I'm going to be. During the show, we also have a live chat at live.twit.tv, and we did take some questions from there this time. We're at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, unless we skip a week like we had to a couple weeks ago. But watch, chat with us, and figure out what we can do. We can ask questions that way. If you happen to be in the Petaluma area today, of course, we're taping this live in Petaluma, I'll be around the rest of the day here. I'm going to be back in Portland for the holidays. You'll probably see me tweet about some karaoke going on up there, so feel free to follow me there. New Year's Eve, I am ringing in the holidays. I'm going to be, I'm ringing New Year's Eve from GMT to PST. I'm going to go live on a webcam from 4 p.m. all the way through midnight. And as we hit each time zone, I'm going to be partying and celebrating. I've got my friends coming over. It's going to be a really great experience. So I did that a couple years ago. Really liked it. In fact, I got on the front page of Ustream with that. So apparently enough people like to watch me party that it seems to be okay. Well, we also did some, we're going to do some Google Plus stuff this year. We're going to do some Hangouts, see if we get that mixed into the stream somehow.
Cool.
Should be a lot of fun. So if you have nothing else to do New Year's Eve, GMT to PST, I'm ringing in every hour. I read out all the countries that are celebrating on New Year's Eve on that time. Also, if you're going to be in the South, the LA area, on January 5th, I'm giving a 2-hour talk on Git. This is an extension of the talk I did for Google Tech Talks. I actually have more material now, and so I'm doing a 2-hour live. I hope we're going to be taping that so I can rebroadcast that. If not, you just have to be there. It's going to be at the Media Temple, obviously enough, the people that have been paying most of my bills lately. But they're actually hosting this event, food and beer. So if nothing else, just come out for the food. That's January 5th. If you Google for UUASC, that's the Unix Users Association of Southern California, eventually, I'm told there's going to be a webpage on it. Jordan, hurry up and get that done. But there's going to be a webpage there. I'm going to be in Daytona the week of January 9th through 12th. So if you're in the Daytona Beach area, Fort Lauderdale on January 13th. Again, follow my Twitter handle. There's just too much stuff coming up for me. But that's sort of the list there. And that's all the plugging I want to do. Aaron, what do you want to plug today?
After that long list, I'm not sure. Wow. I got nothing going on. I'm a loser. you can always go to my website, although I haven't been doing a whole lot there lately. It's just been way too busy, but you can go to thesourceshow.org. You can follow me on aaronnewcomb.com, or, you can go to Google Plus is the best way, actually. So add me to your circles, definitely you can follow everything that goes on there. I often posting about Android stuff that's going on in the Android community and the open source community and the maker community. So, you know, if you're interested in any of those topics, please add me to your circles on Google Plus or, you know, use Facebook or Twitter, whatever you like. Yeah, so that's about it. I think Scale's coming up pretty soon. Are you going to be going to Scale, right?
I'm only at Scale the very last day. I'm coming back from a cruise. The cruise actually, well, the reason I'm in Florida coming up soon is because I'm actually going on a cruise. Right. And so I'm going to miss it. I'm actually getting in Saturday night at 9:30, and I'm staying at the hotel for Scale. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to probably be in the bar at 9:30 Saturday night. Like
as
I often
usual,
am.
Yes.
Like I often am, right? But I'm just going to arrive. I'm just going to sit in the bar because it's a whale. I will be around all day Sunday, but that's usually kind of the dead day there.
It's down day. I was going to say we should maybe think about doing a show down there. But
I'm not going to make it
till
Sunday.
We could do it on the last day, but we'll talk about it.
It'll work. Yeah, we'll figure it out. We're good at that.
Yeah, but I'm on the edge here. I need to get back to those folks, but I'll probably be down at Scale, which is, I think, their 10th anniversary this year. I don't know. I think it's their 10th anniversary.
Right.
It's a big one.
Right.
It's a big deal. They got lots of special guests and stuff. So if you're in the LA area or will be in the LA area around the time that Scale is, you should definitely check it out.
Absolutely.
Great
Absolutely.
Conference. Great Linux and open source conference.
And Aaron, thanks again for being the co-host of the show and driving all the way up from your place in the Bay Area.
Absolutely. So. A big 30-minute drive. It was a rough one, but I made it.
Yes,
I
drive about 5 miles down the road from my hotel today, so that worked out much easier for me. Although I flew up here last night, I got in about 11 p.m. and had to drive till midnight. So I didn't get to the hotel till midnight. It was a little crazy yesterday, but we managed. And I'll be around the rest of the day, and I'll actually fly me out tomorrow. So again, if you're in the Bay Area and want to come up Petaluma and hang out with us, it's fine. I'm going to actually stick around. I'm going to try to photobomb every other show that gets taped here today. So watch for me in the videos like Security Now and TNT and stuff. I want to see if I can photobomb every single show.
And he'll be wearing his fez for each of those, right?
Oh, yes. We'll see. That'll be good. Yes, right. And I want to thank, again, actually want to thank the Twitch Studio for hosting us today and letting us come in and sit here live. This is really, really cool. And for the sodas and everything they're providing. And again, just having a place to go. And all the guys, actually, you know, we really don't, we need a credit roll because all these great people like John and stuff that work behind the scenes really hard, Chad, editing, all that stuff.
Jeff.
I mean, we really need a scroll for all the people that do the work behind the scenes. But thanks, guys, for all the work you do here. And I'll probably be seeing them in person all day today. So it'll be a lot of fun. So, happy appropriate holiday. Festivus coming up in a couple days. That's the one I'm celebrating. Festivus. Yeah, it's for the rest of us. All right. So without further ado, I hear that music coming up behind me. Not really, but we pretend every time. So it must be that time to say we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.
Merry Christmas, everyone.